Hi everyone! Welcome back to another episode of the Crime Hour. Before I begin, I would like to say that this episode does contain sexual matter and graphic descriptions, so if you are not comfortable with that, feel free to skip this week's episode. Today we're going to be talking about the Gainesville Ripper. And yes, this is a man who inspired the Scream movies. So, Daniel Harold Rowling, who went by Danny, was born on May 26, 1954 in Shreveport, Louisiana, to a 19-year-old mother named Claudia and a father named James, who was a police officer. Now, Danny was abused for most of his childhood by his father. At 6 months, his father kicked him into a wall. What the fuck is wrong with him? Okay. At 1 year old, his father beat him because Danny crawled funny. A year later, his mother gave birth to another son, who they named Kevin. And as the boys got older, their father would beat the two of them. Okay, I just want to say something. One, that's really fucked up for a father to do at 6 months. Two, he's a police officer, what the fuck. Three, FYI, Mr. James, every kid crawls funny. I don't know, like, every kid is different, and there is no perfect way to crawl. I mean, come on, some kids even skip the crawling stage and go straight to walking. Who knows, right? So, yeah, I bet you crawled funny. But besides the point, still really fucked up. When Danny was 5 years old, his family got a puppy. And unfortunately, his dad would beat the puppy so bad that by the time Danny tried to comfort the puppy, it had died in his arms. That is so traumatizing for a child. Like, imagine at 5 years old, you watch your own pet die. Between the ages of 6 to 8, his father would beat him twice a week. At 13, his father handcuffed him to Kevin and beat the two boys until they were like really bruised up, and then he would just leave the two outside handcuffed. Okay, listen, you're beating your children like this and they're handcuffed because he's a police officer, right? So he has handcuffs. But I would like to know, if you're doing that to your own children, I don't want to know what you're doing to people that you're arresting. You are the type of person that should not be working as a law enforcement officer. You should not be anything like that. Hell, you should rot in hell. You should, you know, somebody should call, like, CAS or something. At age 14, Danny was caught peeping at his neighbor's daughter through a window, and this led to James beating him some more. At this point, Danny had so much anger built up from all the childhood trauma and stuff, and you know what, I don't blame him. Okay, he tried to stay in control of it, like he tried to control his own emotions. So instead of, you know, like doing something which would be really bad, he decided he was just gonna move out. So he moves out and he goes lives with his grandfather. And him and his grandfather would go to church and, like, you know, try to do normal stuff that kids should be doing. And later on, he decides he was going to enlist into the Navy, but unfortunately, they didn't accept him. So Danny decided to join the Air Force. So at this point, Danny's in the Air Force. He's moved out. You think, oh, he's in a better environment, right? He's going to church. He's not being abused anymore. But because he has so much trauma and anger built up, he didn't find any comfort through going to church or joining the Air Force. He was still unhappy with his life. So he decided to turn to drugs, and this led him to take acid more than 100 times, and it caused him to quit the Air Force. Like, he wasn't let go. He just decided, this is not for me anymore, I'm just gonna go. But, you know, he leaves the Air Force and he goes back to living with his grandfather. And he doesn't like turn to drugs as often. Instead, he decides to attend church more, which is great, right? Like, find yourself, like, do what you believe in, whatever. Everybody has their own beliefs. And, like, if church is helping, church is helping, right? And things were starting to look great for Danny. Like, the sky was blue, he was going to church, he felt like he was happier. He ended up getting married. But at the age of 23, Danny and his wife separated in 1977. Because Danny started threatening to kill her. Because growing up, that was how he was raised, that the father was abusive. So now he's turning all that anger and he's putting it out on her. So she's like, fuck this shit, I'm out. So they separated. After she left, Danny was devastated. He was like, fuck, right? Like, I thought I was in a happy place. I had everything going for me, and now I'm kind of back at having nothing. So the anger builds up again, and like everything hang from, like the abuse, leaving the Air Force, and how, the Navy didn't want him, and his wife leaving, it just, everything just came and like it just hit him all at once, right? Like all that anger, he's like, he couldn't control it anymore. So it resulted in him raping a woman who resembled his ex-wife, and within that year, he also got himself into a really bad car accident in which he ended up killing the other driver. And this incident was it. That it triggered something in him, like a switch went off, and Danny was like, he wasn't sure if he liked the fact that he ended up killing her. He was devastated at one point because he was like, oh my fucking God, what did I do? How could I do this? Like, I'm not this type of person. I'm not my father. I don't hurt people. I'm trying to be a better person. I go to church. I'm trying to find happiness. I'm not the type of person I wouldn't, abuse somebody. Right? That's what's going on in his head. But another part of him is like, whoa, that's kind of like exhilarating. Like, that's kind of cool. Like, I killed somebody and I wasn't charged for murder because it was a car accident. Maybe I could get away with this. That's what's happening now. So he has two sides of things going on in his mind and he didn't know how to control it. And you know what? I think with that, it really affects somebody because it's like you don't know which emotions to show, you don't know what you want to do anymore. And like it was really, really taking a toll on Danny because he was so like confused as to who he was or who he wanted to be. And because of this, it led to Danny, and he's about 6'2", okay? And it led to him getting into a lot of trouble with the law from 1970 to 1990 from robberies, theft for cash, and it took it, and because of this, it like caused him to be in and out of criminal justice systems in Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama. And, because of all of this, it's like now he knew what side he wanted. He wanted the thrill of, being bad, so people would say. And his grandfather was like, fuck that you, like, no, you did not leave your house to be a wreck at my house, right? Like, I am not having the law enforcement, like, come to the door every single time you get yourself into shit. So you need to get the fuck out. So Danny decides to move back home with his parents, which was a bad idea because remember, his dad was really abusive. And when he moved back in, it didn't stop. Like, his dad just continued to abuse him, even as an adult now. And in May of 1990, Danny had completely lost it with his father, and they got into a really heated argument, and it caused A lot of commotions in the house, and Danny just had enough, so he shoots his father twice. Danny thinks that his father is now bleeding out, right? Like he's on the ground, and he's like, okay, I think I killed him. I think I killed him. So, you know what? I don't want to be caught for this. I don't want to be involved when if law enforcement comes. So I'm just gonna make a run for it. So Danny packs up his shit and he goes to Florida. He's like on the run, right? But what he didn't know, because he was on the run, was James ends up surviving. He just lost an eye and an ear. Which I want to say is bullshit because, one, James deserves to die. Like, I don't care. Like, you are a piece of shit for abusing your own children. If you abuse people, you are a piece of shit. And so, to me, I believe that James should be dead. Okay? You can come at me all you want, but that's just what I'm gonna believe because it's not right. Like, abusers should not get to live freely. So, Danny's on the run, okay? He ends up in Florida. On August 24th, 1990, students were moving into their dorms at Gainesville University, located in Florida, when roommates Christina Powell and Sonia Larson both headed to Walmart to grab last-minute things for their dorm room. Okay? Little did they know, someone had been watching them at Walmart, and this person followed them home. Later that night, the dorm got really quiet, and as days went on, nobody heard from the girls, nobody seen the girls on campus, nothing, right? But Christina's parents had planned to come and visit her on August 26th, like so that just before school starts, right? They wanted to come see her, they wanted to meet her roommate, Sonia, they wanted to, make sure she had everything that she needed because she was studying away from home and stuff like that. But when her parents arrived, they knocked on the door, but no one answered. And they listened closely to the door, like at the door, and they didn't hear anybody. So they thought, hey, this is really odd because Christina knows that we're coming, right? And like, where would she have gone? Because her car was still in the parking lot, like, unless she was on campus, but like, her parents told her what time they would be there. So there wouldn't be any reason why she would be on campus or whatever the case may be. Like, they were expecting her to be home as she was expecting them, right? And because they couldn't hear anybody, they didn't see them, nobody heard from them or whatever, her parents start to panic and they call the authorities. And when the authorities came, they knocked down the door and they were inside the dorm now. And inside the dorm, the parents and the authorities are there, and Christina's parents found both girls dead. The first body they found was Sonia's, and she was laid out on top of her bed, and her bed was on the top floor of this dorm, so I guess like one of those dorms that are like two floors. And so she was at the top level of that house or whatever, and her bedroom's there, and they see that Sonia Larson is dead in her bedroom. And when authorities came in, authorities had believed that she had been attacked in her sleep and that she had been stabbed 20 times. There was a sticky residue over her mouth, su suggesting that she had been taped up. She also had cuts all over her hands and arms, which show that she was trying to fight back her attacker. And once she had died, the killer had actually dragged her body to the bottom of the bed. And the killer then displayed Sonia's body in like a sexual position. Okay, I just want to point out one, what the fuck? Two, I want to know what kind of tape this killer is using because from what I know, tape doesn't leave a sticky residue right away. right? Like, if you were to tape or put tape on something and you rip it off, it's not like right away the sticky residue is there. It usually takes maybe like a couple days or like a long period of time before you get that sticky residue, right? So I want to know, what kind of tape is this person using? Like, I'm curious because it must be some special kind of tape. It's what happened to her is terrible, okay? I cannot imagine what she had gone through. Imagine it was your first night there. You haven't even started school. You didn't even get to experience college or university life. First night there, you're with your roommate. This happens. And she was attacked in her sleep. So I could just imagine, like, being startled and, like, you know, when you're already asleep, like, and you first wake up, it's like your vision is not focused, right? Like, it takes a couple minutes. So it's like you're just kind of like fighting at something. You don't even know. You can't even say what it was. And then this person is just stabbing you 20 times. Like, I could not. I don't. This poor girl. The killer then went downstairs to where Christina was sleeping, and she fell asleep on the couch. And it was said that during the investigation, police could tell that the killer actually spent a lot more time with Christina due to the fact that this time the killer had time to tape her arms, like her hands behind her back and stuff like that, so that she couldn't fight back. And her mouth was also taped, and you could tell that Christina was actually violently raped before the killer decided to flip her over onto her stomach and stab her in the back 5 times. Again, the killer displayed her body in a sexual manner after, but this time he actually ended up mutilating her and cutting off her nipples, and he placed one nipple next to the body, and he took the other one with him. Okay, so clearly, this killer is really fucked in the head. These poor girls, and the fact that, like, you would think, like, is it not bad enough that you're attacking these people in their sleep, like these poor young girls, and like, you're attacking them, you're killing them, like you're stabbing them. But to go and also rape this girl and mutilate her, like, oh my God. I could just, and imagine, like, that's how her parents found her. Like, oh. During the investigation, police found a towel and a bottle of dish soap by Christina's body, and the killer had actually tried to wash her body with it to try and get rid of any evidence. The girl's clothes were actually not violently ripped off or taken off or whatever, but the killer had actually used that same knife that he used to stab the girls. He actually used that same knife to cut their clothes off, which is really, like, I can't wrap my head around the fact that these poor girls were just, you know, they were excited about university life. They were excited to be adults, right? And, like, their first night there is, like, you know, I couldn't even imagine. And I couldn't even imagine what, like, Christina's parents found the girls like that. And they didn't even know Sonia, right? Can you imagine, like, how Sonia's family felt when they found out the news? Like, ugh, it's so heartbreaking. Just 8 hours after the first murders, 18-year-old Krista Holt goes missing, and she was a student at Santa Fe College, and she worked as a records clerk for the local police department. And she had an actual, so she was scheduled a shift at midnight, but she didn't show up. And this was odd to her coworkers, right? 'Cause it's like when you don't show up for your shift, it's really out of character a lot, right? Because, you know, when you have a job, you're supposed to be responsible. Like, let's say you're sick or something came up, right? You would call ahead of time and being like, hey, listen, I can't come in today. I'm not feeling great. Whatever the case may be, right? Or, you know, hey, sorry, I can't come in. There's an emergency I need to deal with. And if you give them a, you know, give them a heads up so they're not expecting you. But Krista never missed the day of work. Even if she was sick or whatever the case may be, she would always show up to work. She never missed a day. So it was really out of character for her to not show up for this shift. And nobody has heard from her. So a couple of the police officers at the department decided to go over to her apartment to check up on her. And when they knocked, no one answered. So police would go around, because her apartment, she lived on the ground floor of the apartment, so the first floor. So they were able to walk around to see, like, the windows or whatever. And as police walked around, they noticed that a part of the fence has been bent, as if somebody had actually tried to climb over it or, like, you know, tampered with it. And it's just, it was like the whole fence was like still staying, like it was still up except for that one part that was just bent over. The police then noticed the sliding glass doors that would lead to the backyard had been tampered with, and they could see that the locks had been tampered with, and it was like there was a gap, so the door was actually open, which would be very out of character for anybody, right? Because like past midnight, you should have all your doors locked, right? Like you shouldn't have anything open, even if you've forgotten. Like you would, you know, one would not ever leave the house for work or to go to sleep at night without checking if all their doors are locked, right? Or so I hope. Okay. But her slide door also had blinds that were kind of like, I guess, somewhat attached to it, if you know what I mean. Like, it's hard to explain, but like, okay, so for me at my house, my slide door has blinds, like the long curtain ones, and you have to pull the string for it to go all the way across. But for her, for Krista's, it wasn't it didn't go across. It was more like one of those regular curtain blinds that only went up and down. So the police noticed that one that side of the door that was open, that blind was actually crooked, as if it was like bent. So an officer actually bends down to take a peek inside, and that's when they notice that Krista was dead. Her body was sitting upright on her bed, but she was decapitated. Oh my fucking god. Here we go. Emily can't read or spell, okay? I cannot read for the life of me. But you know what I mean, okay? Her head was not there. This has just became another crime scene. So at this point, police were like, okay, now we have to investigate. So they go into the house, right? They go into the house. They're looking around for, you know, evidence and stuff like that, clues, etc. Right there in her bedroom, her body is, she's sitting upright on her bed, okay? But, like, you know, like against her bed frame or whatever. But remember, she is decapitated. So they're like, who would do this, right? But across from her bed is a bookshelf, and the killer had put her head on the bookshelf, staring right back at her body. Is that creepy or what? Also, I want to point out that officer who bent down to look under that curtain, boy, that officer was brave. I've watched enough horror movies to know that if you were to do that, there is somebody staring back at you. There would be a demon or, you know, a killer staring back right at you. Like, it would not just be an empty room you're looking into. Mm-mm. talking, I can just see the jump scare, just like the music cueing in, and then you look under and boom, there's somebody there. Okay, I have watched a lot of horror movies. And you can tell it has fucked with my mind, right? Like that's what I think of when somebody tells me they're gonna just go look under, and I'm like, are you crazy? Are you fucking nuts? The police had determined the cause of death for Krista was a single stab wound to the back. Again, it was the same way that the other victims were killed. She was raped. Her clothes were cut off by the knife, stabbed, and again, her nipples were cut off, but this time the killer had just left both her nipples right next to her body. But it had also been noted that Krista had been laying on her back for a long time when after she was killed, before the killer decided to prop her up. And the only reason why the police know this is because the bed sheets, there was the blood discoloration after, you know, like if you get a bloody nose, or you know, you hurt yourself. If you leave the blood there for a while and you don't clean it up, you know, it's a dark stain. So that's what they saw on the bed sheets, right? And that's how they determined that she was actually killed and laid on her. She was actually killed and then, you know, laid there for a while before the killer decided to prop her up. That Monday, the police broke the news that there was a serial killer at large targeting women in university or college housing. Yeah. If I was in college and that happened and I was living in a dorm, yeah, I would pack up my shit and drop out and be like, "You know what? I'll just learn from home. I'll just do the online classes." You know, like I'm not, I don't need to be there. Sometime that same day, two more students were reported missing, both 23 years old. They were Tracy Paulus and Manuel Tabota. But for Manuel, his friends called him Manny. So Manny's friends, were looking for him because they're like, oh, we haven't heard from him in a while. And you know, school hasn't started yet, so let's you know, like see if we can do a last minute hangout, right? Before everybody goes back to college or whatever. Now, they knew that Manny was roommates with Tracy, and they actually went to high school together, and that's how they became roommates, because they're like, oh, you're going to the same college as me. You want to be roommates? That way we don't have to be stuck with strangers. And they were like, yeah, sure, whatever. So Manny's friends go to their dorm, right? And they're like knocking on the door. Nobody comes to the door. Again, they don't hear anything. And you know, like, you know, the little gap underneath the door where you can see light or whatever. They didn't see a light, right? It was dark. I guess they had the curtains over their window, so like they couldn't see nothing, right? So they're like, huh, that's really strange. So they went to the campus manager and they're like, hey, we're trying to check up on our friend. We haven't heard from him in a while. Do you think you can let us in? So the campus manager was like, yeah, sure, why not? Campus manager and Manny's friends go back to that dorm. And when the manager opened the door, all they saw was blood and a black bag. And that alone scared the shit out of them. The campus manager shut the door quickly, and the manager and all the friends ran outside and they were like, what the fuck was that? Holy shit. Did you see that? Was that blood? Like, you know, like they were panicking. And then, so they decided we're gonna call authorities. When the police showed up and they went back to the dorm, the black bag was gone. Police then had a theory that the killer must have still been in there when they went to go check, and it startled the killer. So the killer must have, after they ran out, the killer must have grabbed the bag and escaped through the window or something, right? Like a side window where they wouldn't have been able to see, or whatever the case may be. And so inside this dorm, the police find Tracy's body lying in the hallway, although evidence showed that she was killed in her bedroom and then dragged out of the hallway. Again, the same killing method. Okay, rape, cause of death was 3 stab wounds to the back. She was laid out in a sexual manner. And Manny was attacked in his sleep. He was stabbed all over, from his face, arms, legs, and torso. And it was said that Manny was killed before Tracy. And the reason why was because they had to get rid of the stronger opponent, right? Like they had to kill Manny because they knew that Manny could fight back. Now, at this point, police weren't sure what the target was, because at first they believed that the target was only young women, right? Because all the other victims were young women. And they all had the same features: petite, brown hair, brown eyes. But now, with Manny being dead, they're like, holy shit, it could be anybody. They could just be targeting any student in any housing, in any dorms, whatever the case may be, at any school. But after these 5 murders, the killings just stopped. It was like whoever was the killer had enough. They were like, that's it, I'm done. It's not fun anymore. So, because of this, it gave police a lot of time to actually fully investigate all 5 murders, murder crime scenes. Sorry, I couldn't think of the word. And, fully do a full investigation, trying to match, hey, like, what's actually accurate about this one and this one, and how do they connect to together, right? So what the police had found out while they were doing this was all the apartments or dorms all had sliding glass doors. They were all tampered with. All of them faced a yard, like a backyard or a field or whatever the case may be, which would give the killer a chance to be able to hide in the dark, because then if it was a field or a backyard, they were able to hide behind bushes or trees without being seen at night. And they were able to watch, right? To make sure what time lights out were, whatever the case may be. All the women have suffered the same assault, rape, being taped up, etc. Right? The killer had also used the same knife to kill every single victim, and it was the same knife that cut off all the clothes. The killer also removed the tape once all the victims were dead. So there was no tape left behind, nothing. And it was said that the killer must have used gloves to try to hide evidence. The police decided not only to look at the dorms, but they looked in lakes, wooded areas, rivers, garbage bins, anywhere that the killer could have disposed any of the evidence. But unfortunately, nothing came out of it. So now everyone in Gainesville was in panic mode, right? Students started to sleep together in groups, and they would take turns, like, okay, I'm gonna sleep from this time to this time, and you're gonna stay awake. And they would just take turns so that somebody was always awake. Stores started to sell out of all their, like, I guess, safety precaution stuff, quickly, like guns, baseball bats, pepper spray, anything for self-defense was starting to sell out quick. It was like COVID. Everybody was just panicking over toilet paper, but this is more serious, obviously, and they were just selling out of all these self-defense weapons. a lot of the students even dropped out of colleges, and residents actually started to stay in hotels because they felt safer in a hotel than they did in their own home, because in a hotel there were security guards, etc. Like, nobody can get in unless you check in and you had a key, right? So they were like, yeah, we're not going to stay home. And then the school campuses hired security guards to watch over dorms and student housing. So guards would also take turns, you know, like standing guard. And you know what? I don't blame the students who decided to drop out, because I would have dropped out. I would have been like, hey, don't mind me. I'm packing my shit. I'm getting the fuck out of here, right? And again, I would have also carried a self-defense thing. Even while I dropped out, I would have been like, not taking any chances, trusting nobody, right? Like, I'm not opening the door for nobody. I won't do nothing. I will be just isolating in my room. Now, people in the city, or whatever, of Gainesville, were starting to suspect anybody who looked suspicious. A lot of people thought it could be the pizza delivery man, because they were thinking, hey, when you order a pizza, the man, whoever, it could be the killer, right? And you would never suspect it because he's just delivering your pizza. And then other people actually started suspecting the police, because they're like, oh, they're authority and stuff like that. Nobody's going to suspect authority figures to, like, you know, be killers. So they're like, oh, maybe it was the police. And then when you call them for an emergency or whatever the case, maybe they'll show up and they'll kill you. And this made it really hard for police, because in order for them to do their jobs, when there's like a serial killer at large, obviously they need the community to trust them. And because people are starting to suspect the police, they were losing trust, right? Like, people were losing trust in them. They're like, I don't know if we should even believe what they say. Right? So police then decide, we're going to make a suspect profile, which is just like a rough idea that the police have in mind from gathering all the evidence. They just have a rough idea of what this person could be like. So the police say it could be a white male in their late 20s and 30s, around 6 feet, single, kind of a loner, or on the weird side, you know, like awkward, and a good knowledge of police work. And police also believe that this person had a lengthy criminal past and has some experience in the military. And while this was happening, all the results from all the evidence that they got, like the DNA forensics, they were all coming back, right? DNA found on Christina's underwear, along with a paper towel found by her body, tested positive for semen. This semen match was like, also like, the semen also matched with the samples from Krista's body, so now they know it's the same killer. Police then created a list of 675 men in the Gainesville area who had criminal pasts, or some had criminal pasts. Some had just been a tip-off from community saying that they're kind of weird, you know, they're kind of awkward, they kind of look sus. And so police decided all 675 men are going to give us a sample of, you know, their saliva, a sample of their semen, because that was a match, right, in two of the girls. So they're like, all 675 men are going to give us those samples. So during all this, one man that actually stood out to the police was Edward Humphreys, who was 18 years old. His name was actually tipped off more than once by neighbors. So obviously police start looking into Edward, right? Like, they try to search him up on their computer. And it showed that Edward used to live in the same complex as Tracy and Manny. And so they went to the complex again, and, you know, and they asked around, and it was said that many people knew that Edward had a crush on Tracy. But the only reason why Edward doesn't live there anymore was because he was kicked out due to the fact that he was having erratic behavior and threatening the tenants. So the landlord was like, "I don't want you here." And Edward had always carried a knife with him everywhere he went, and he always wore camouflage clothing, try and blend in the wooded areas, which was really sus. And he was really weird. He was a loner, didn't have much friends. So during the time of the murders, it was really weird when they got a tip that Edward was saying random stuff to a bank teller when he went to go to the bank. And obviously the lady got freaked out, so she called the authorities. And it was said that Edward had told this bank teller that he had knives at home that were so sharp it could rip out her skin. Like, what the fuck? Who the fuck says that? Except for a psychopath. Imagine you at your workplace. You are a bank teller and you're like, "Oh, how may I help you today?" And he's just like, "I have knives at home. So sharp. They could rip off your skin." What do you do? Right? What do you do at that point? I'd be like, "Give me one second," and then I'd just go to the back and call authorities, right? I would not, I'd be like, "I'll just back away." And then after that, I would probably tell my boss, "Listen, I need to go home now. I don't feel safe." August 30th, Edward was actually arrested for aggravated assault against his own grandmother. Who the fuck does that? What the fuck? And he was immediately taken to a mental health facility to be assessed. The psychiatrist at the center diagnosed Edward with bipolar disorder, and police decided that since Edward was already at this mental health facility, they're gonna go to him and they're gonna question him there. And so they questioned Edward about the murders. And Edward seemed to know a lot about the bodies and how the victims were before they were killed and after they were killed. And he was able to describe what the crime scene looked like at the end, like how the women were, how the there was stab wounds, etc. Like, he was able to describe every detail. And of course, now this is a really big red flag to the police, right? They're like, "Okay, we might have our killer now," right? Because who the fuck knows all that shit, right? Like, you wouldn't know unless you were the one, right, who committed these crimes, because on the news they don't tell you how they were killed. They just say, an example is a man has been stabbed in Ontario, right? Like, certain part of an Ontario, like in southern Ontario. Or two missing police are searching for two missing people, right? They don't tell you what happens to them after when they find them, right? So now Edward's being arrested, right? But his bail was set to $1 million. But he wasn't being arrested for the murders because they don't have proof. They just have what he says. He's being arrested for the aggravated assault. Imagine your bail is $1 million for aggravated assault. What the fuck? So at this point, people in the community starting to trust police again, and they think, okay, police said that they have a suspect. So now people are starting to feel safe because they're like, "Oh, I think they caught the killer." Edward was arrested, and he was already getting the police were already receiving lots of tips about Edward and how he was awkward. So when he was arrested, they're like, oh my god, they caught the killer. Everything can go back to normal. Meanwhile, the police were like, okay, we need more evidence. So while he's locked up, we're going to go search his apartment. And when the police got inside this apartment, it was like two different people were living in there. One side was neat, tidy, clean. It was as if like this person was so organized. They cleaned their place really nice. Like you wouldn't even tell that something was going on in this house. The other side of the apartment was a pigsty. There was broken glass, there was trash everywhere, it was all messy, like, you know, there was dust. It was literally two different people. But Edward lived alone, so it was that bipolarness that kicked in. But nothing in this apartment linked Edward to any of those murders. None of the knives that he quote-unquote had matched up with whatever knife was used to actually kill these five victims. So now police are like, fuck, we don't have anybody. This is not our guy. Now, what do we do now? Right? So they're like, now we need more help. So the police are like, we're gonna have to contact the FBI. So they contact the FBI, and the FBI has this program called VCAP, which stands for Violent Criminal Apprehension Program. And it stores details of every violent crime that's ever happened in the United States. So what it was officers could use this program to compare crimes by putting in key details in the system, and it scans for crimes similar to what they're looking for. So police search up unsolved homicides or whatever, right? Or like stabbed victims. And eight similar cases came up, and one of them was almost identical to the one that's happening in Gainesville. So an unsolved triple homicide from Shreveport, Louisiana, on November 4th, 1989. Remember who was from Shreveport? 24-year-old Julie Grissom, 55-year-old William, and 8-year-old Sean were killed. And it was unsolved. And in this, it was someone had broken in and attacked them, stabbing them all to death. William and Sean were killed in the living room, and Julie was taken upstairs to her bedroom where she was taped up, raped, and then killed. Sound familiar? Now, police are looking at it, and they're like, I think we got something here, right? They're like, I think this case ties into what's happening here. So they're connecting these cases together. Which would make it a total of 8 people killed. Again, they go back to the list of 675 people, but this time they're excluding Edward. So it's 674. And now they're looking at 674 men, and they're trying to see if any of them had ever been to Louisiana. Now, during this time that they're investigating and they're going through all the files of 674 men, the police get a phone call from a different police station in Florida stating that they had just arrested a man for armed robbery. This man they arrested is not from Gainesville. He was from Shreveport, Louisiana. So now they're starting to do a background check on this man, right? They're like, oh, give me the name of this person. Let me run a background check while you have him there. So they're looking it back, and they find that this man is wanted for attempted murder of his own father. This man was 37-year-old Danny Rowling. So now, remember, James is alive, so now he wants Danny dead, right? Because he reported him to the police, and now Danny's on the run. Danny Rowling, a man with a lengthy criminal past, matches almost identical to the Gainesville Ripper suspect's descriptions. Because of this, police believe that Danny is the guy that they're looking for. And remember, James was a police officer, right? Danny had learned to cover his tracks because his father taught him how to, even though his father abused him. And remember, police said that whoever this killer was had a little bit of knowledge with police work. So, the Gainesville police arrest Danny, and because he was arrested for armed robbery, it was stated that Danny and a black male were involved in an armed robbery at the bank the morning of Krista's murder. And when they first tried to confront Danny and his accomplice about it, Danny had made a run for it into a wooded area. So the police are following him into this wooded area. And when they get there, like into this wooded area, they find a campsite with tent, clothes, a bag, screwdriver, and a bag full of cash covered in red dye. Obviously, the bank money. All the items had been taken in for evidence. Now, one of the items taken at the campsite was a ski mask, and the police took fibers from it and compared it to the fibers that they found on the tape. And that tape was from the third murder scene, and it was a match. A pair of pants in one of the bags had a spot of blood, and it matched the blood of Manny. The screwdriver found at the campsite matched the one that was making the markings on the sliding doors. Because remember, it was tampered with, and it was tampered with a screwdriver. And it had matched with all the sliding doors. And so they're like, so this is how Danny got in. One of Krista's pubic hairs was also found in his sleeping bag, and the police also find a tape recorder, Walkman thing, with headphones at the site, and when they listened to the tape, it was Danny making a recording to his brother and his mother. And it said, "I know I have to run for the rest of my life, but I'm getting pretty good at it. I don't want you feeling sorry for me. I don't want you worrying about me. I'm a big boy. I can take care of myself. We're all down here for just a breath anyways. Well, I'm going to sign off for a little bit. I got something I got to do." End of tape. So police believe that these recordings were actually made before any of the murders took place. Danny was still held in jail for the armed robbery, right? So police paid him a visit, but Danny was not cooperating. He didn't want to answer any of the questions that the police were asking him. He didn't give eye contact. He was just, he was mute. Man, oh man, Danny, what did you get yourself into? Now you're screwed for life. But although Danny wouldn't answer any questions, he let police take his fingerprints, saliva, blood sample, and then, police then told him in front of 3 to 5 other people as witness that they need at least 30 to 50 pubic hairs for testing. Danny stood up, unzipped his pants, and with his bare hands, he ripped out 2 handfuls of pubic hair and slammed it on the table and was like, "This should be about 50. One, ouch. 2, what the fuck? Who just does that? And 3, okay, I can't picture, like not even picture, I can feel the pain. Oh my god. Ugh." So after a few weeks, the results from all of the blood sample, the fingerprints, all of that came back, and it was a match to all 3 crime scenes. Danny was now charged with 5 counts of first-degree murder, 3 counts of sexual battery, and 3 counts of armed burglary. Not looking good for you, Danny. No, no. Now, DNA testing was quite new, so police knew that they can't just take that as proof. They needed Danny to confess. But Danny wasn't cooperating, right? He wasn't talking to them. But when Danny was in jail, he became really good friends with his cellmate, Bobby Lewis. Now, Bobby was quite known in the prison because he was the very first person who's ever illegally escaped death row. How? Don't know. Now, Danny had figured, okay, shit. They caught me. I'm in a lot of shit right now, right? Like, I fucked up. And he knew that whatever it was that he did was probably gonna get him landed in death row. So he was like, hey, Bobby was able to escape from it. I'm gonna ask him for advice. So he starts talking to Bobby, but Bobby goes, I can't tell you anything until I know what you did. You need to tell me what exactly you did that landed you here in the first place. So Danny tells Bobby in detail of all the crimes, like every victim, what he did, etc. So now Bobby knows everything, but then Danny tells Bobby he wants to be a superstar. He wants to be like Ted Bundy. Dude, Danny, come on. One, terrible role model. Don't look up to a man like him. Two, oh boy. You don't have to worry about being as famous as Ted Bundy, man. We've got movies based on your shit. Three, come on. Out of all role models, of all things you want to do, you don't want to be a better person in this world? You don't want to, like, you know, be a better role model? No, you're just going to look up to another serial killer? Okay, well, yeah, now you really fucked up. A month before the trials, Danny asked to speak to the Gainesville police. He was ready to confess. Danny didn't want to confess directly to the police. He wanted Bobby there. So, he would whisper all of his answers to Bobby whenever police asked him a question, and Bobby would just repeat it. And that was how they got the confession. But this took hours, right? Because Danny was just not speaking for himself. Danny ends up confessing to the 5 murders, but would not speak about the Grissom family murders. He said, I'll clean it up within due time. Police asked Danny, what was the reasoning behind all of these killings? And Danny says, I wanted to kill a person for every year I was in jail. And for all those armed robberies, you know, like from, remember when I mentioned Louisiana, Mississippi, Georgia, and Alabama. So that was 8 years. He spent 8 years in prison. He wanted to kill somebody for every year that he was in prison. So he ended up killing the 8 people. Really fucked up, man. In April 1994, trial took place, and the deal was that Danny would take a plea stating that he was not guilty due to insanity, due to his, you know, fucked up childhood and took a toll on him, PTSD, whatever the case may be. Then, at the beginning of the trial, nobody knew he was going to do this. Not his attorney, not his lawyer, you know, like, nobody. Nobody in that courtroom knew he was going to do this. Danny stood up and pleaded guilty to all 5 murders. Now, this shocked everybody because they're like, what the fuck are you doing? We talked about it. You're going to try and plead that you're insane, right? But he pleaded guilty on his own. Danny was sentenced to death on April 20th, 1994, but wasn't executed until October 25th, 2006. He sat on death row for 12 years. His last meal was lobster, shrimp, baked potatoes, cheesecake, and sweet tea. Damn, he knew how to pick a meal, man. That's really 5 course right there. He was then taken to the execution room, where this room was made up with, instead of walls, it was just glass windows, okay? And so that way, all the victims that, you know, their family suffered could watch him die. Danny was given the lethal injection and died at 6 p.m. that day. 2 weeks after Danny's death, a woman named Janet Frank came forward and said that she was a survivor from the Gainesville Ripper. Janet had claimed that she was attacked in her home, and Danny tried to handcuff her, but the handcuffs wouldn't lock, so he ended up using tape instead. He also taped her eyes, raped her, and then told her that he was going to rape her over and over again while he took her to the bathroom and raped her again. Then Danny then told Janet that after that, he's going to rape her all night, and after that, he's going to kill her and leave her body in the closet. During all this, Janet was very calm. She played it smart. She was like, "Oh, he's probably just lonely. He probably had a rough childhood. He just needs somebody to talk to." So she started talking to him as if they were friends. She's like, "Oh my God, how's it going? It's been so long. Would you like something to eat? Like, how's your life going with you? You know, like, how's your parents?" She talked to him calmly, and he started to talk to her too, right? Like, they started having a conversation. And then Danny then asked, "If it was any other circumstance, do you think we would date?" Janet was so disgusted by this, but she didn't show it. Now, Janet was actually very into true crime herself, so she knew what to do, really, because she watched all these crime shows and read about them in books, etc. So she goes, "Hey, do you want something to drink?" So she goes to the kitchen, right? Because at this point, Danny's guard is off, right? He's like, "Oh, she's talking to me. Oh, maybe we could be friends. Maybe she could be more than that. I shouldn't kill her." So she goes to the kitchen, gets some beer, but she pours it in a glass because she said, "I knew that if he was going to kill me, I needed him to leave evidence for the police so that when she handed him the glass, his fingerprints would be on it so that it would be evidence. And because he raped her, she kept a towel with his semen on it in her bathroom hidden so that if the glass wasn't enough, they had semen to back up." Janet was very smart. And because of this, she actually survived. Danny, after having that beer and after having that talk, he actually let her live and he left. He left her house and he never looked back. He never came back for her, nothing. He just went on with his five murders, eight murders, whatever. So this is the case of the Gainesville Ripper. So now when you're watching the Scream movies, you're gonna know what it's based off of. I hope you enjoyed this week's episode. Yeah. Until next week, bye!